everybody, and welcome to the Yishai Fleischer Show, broadcasting live, Bezrat Hashem, with the help of God from Judea. You're a part of it wherever you are. Shalom and welcome. Shalom and welcome to Malka Fleischer.
Hi there.
How you doing, Malka?
I have a little cold.
Oh, man.
I have that, like, there's a thing that everyone has now, this, like, between seasons. See, I know that in places like New York, you've already gotten, like, a record snowfall and all this stuff. You guys are, like, solidly in wintertime. But here in Israel, I feel like we're still like transitioning into winter.
Oh, yeah.
I think part of that also is that we're not getting very much rain.
That's right.
Which is not a good thing, seeing as here in Israel, like for 6 months a year, we get zero rain. And that's just part of how it works here in Israel from like right after Pesach until Sukkot, which is 6 months, which is half a year. There is zero rain. You are expected zero rain. And so after that, in the winter, that's like all of our rain.
That's
and
right.
We're not getting any rain almost. So, yeah. So there's like a lot of viruses and stuff flying around.
So let's, okay, that's one way. Okay, let's ask everybody to pray for the rain.
Yes.
In Eretz Yisrael. Okay, because the rain in Israel falls mainly
on the...
In the winter. So therefore,
that was
I want you
good and rhythmical.
Yeah, so I want you to please pray, especially if you're in a place that doesn't have enough water. Let's say like California or Texas or these places.
Arizona.
That like needs more water. You pray for our water and we'll send you blessings right back. That's the way it works. That's the way it works. Oh, in fact, if you remind me, I'm going to talk about my yoga Dvar Torah, okay?
Okay.
I didn't get a chance to do that yet. I know you know it already, but we'll talk a little bit about that. We'll talk about what goes around comes around when East meets West. That's right, Malka. So let's pray. Let's all pray for the reign of the land of Israel. I just wanted to make sure. You said you're a little sick. Said a little bit of this, a little bit of that. My friend Eric said to me that something in the world that people are concerned with is something called a tridemic.
That sounds awesome.
The combo of flu, respiratory syndrome, and COVID. Are you sure you don't
Can you get them all at the same time?
Yeah,
Or do you just get them one after the other?
It's a 3-4-1, Malka. Okay, you've heard of Black...
That's how I like it.
Black Friday, Cyber Monday.
Yep.
Tridemic Tuesdays, okay? And you could just get it. It's a 3-4-1. So let's keep all away from the tridemic and let's instead heal that tridemic with the awesomeness of Am Yisrael, Be'eretz Yisrael, Pitarat Yisrael.
Okay, nice.
The nation of Israel on the land of Israel.
Trifecta.
Working on the Torah of Israel. That's right. Okay. So, Malka, please have a refuah shlema.
Thank you. Amen.
And the way we're going to pray for you is by praying for everybody who needs a little bit of healing.
There's a lot of people.
Yes. And I want to say that yesterday, the Lord gave me such a sweet and so memorable of an opportunity that I choke up inside because I got to go to the hospital yesterday and go visit... our dear friend, Ofer Ohana, who was injured in a terrorist event, terrorist attack about, I think a month ago, maybe a month and a week ago already now, about a month ago, and it was a Saturday night, and he responded to a call of a terrorist attack in Hebron, a little bit more towards the Arab part of Hebron, and there was a terror attack on a store. And Jews were injured. He came in. He found the guy that was lying on the floor. He had been shot in the head. And Hananya. And he, in the end, actually did not make it.
Right.
But the terrorist had fled the scene when Ofer Ohana was dealing with this...
Injured man. Lethally
right.
Injured man.
Right. The terrorist circled back and in the end shot Ofer Ohana and hit him in the liver and hit him in the arm.
Right.
I yesterday visited Ofer in the hospital, and his liver and all that business is doing rather well.
Thank God.
His arm, on the other hand, definitely needs our prayers. Mm-hmm. He has had some kind of nerve damage. Who the heck knows what happens when, you know, I ain't no surgeon, you know. But
it's complicated. The arm is a whole thing.
Everything's
with
a whole
many
thing.
Different the, ropes of ligaments and tendons.
So
and
this arm is
nerves.
not being like they're not. It's not going gangrene. God forbid.
God forbid.
But it's not responding.
It's not working.
Right. The blood is flowing, but there's
thank
like
God.
Some
so okay. I remember they were concerned he was going to lose his arm.
Yeah.
So right now he's not losing his arm, but he may not have the function of his arm, and that's his main
right arm,
functioning
arm. So I got to go to the hospital to hang out with him. And it was, I got there very early in the morning. Mm-hmm. And I had the merit of helping him put on his tefillin. And I told Uri Karzin, at, the director general of the Jewish community of Hebron, that I got to help Ofer Ochana put on his tefillin. He said to me, that's the shimush. That's called Bikur Cholim. That's really
Bikur Cholim. That's nice, Yishai.
And when we had the Chai Sara event, Chai Sara Shabbat Hebron, just 2 weeks ago, then I mentioned the story that when I called Israel and Hebron in order to get married 20 years ago, Malka.
20 years.
Yeah. And I called somebody there and Hebron answered. And I said, you know, can we get married in Hebron? And he's like, yeah. I'm like, okay. He's like, what date do you want? I'm like, Tu B'Av, the 15th of Av. And that's like the most coveted date on the Jewish calendar for marriage. And the guy's like, okay. I'm like, what do you mean, okay? Who do I have to fight to like make it happen? Do I have to go in front of a committee? Like, is there another wedding happening at the same time? What's the... He says to me, bro, there's nobody getting married around here. It's the Intifada. You're the only one. Don't worry about it. And I told the story, and everybody's like, and I'm like, and then I honored you, and I talked about our marriage 20 years ago, our wedding.
That was really nice.
And then I'm like, and do you know who that guy was? And I gave it a pregnant pause, and people were like,
yeah.
No.
They're like, who?
Who? And they're like, they throw out names. I'm like, nope, 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 nope. They're like, I'm like, it was Ofer Ochana. He answered the phone. It was him, the caterer.
Yeah.
And I mentioned that to the crowd there, and people were choked up, and some people also were moved to donate to the Hebron Fund to help Ofer Ochana
and to replace some of the equipment that was injured in that attack.
Yeah, we had a very expensive car
security
vehicle destroyed, as we say in Hebrew, total loss. That's Yoni Bleichbard's vehicle. Right now we actually have a campaign going on at the Hebron Fund. That's going to be when you're listening to the show. So please go to Hebron Fund and go to the Yishai page and donate there,
right,
to help families, the family of the murdered, the families of the injured, and also to replace our security vehicles so that we won't ever have to.
And so many other projects. Hebron is a place which, on the one hand, they're constantly holding down the fort and they have daily needs and requirements. On the other hand, it's a city that wants to like blossom open. You know, it's a place that wants to make projects and make buildings and clean up and just welcome guests. And there are a lot of costs involved in that.
You bet. And especially honor the tomb of the forefathers and mothers. And beautify it for the nation. It's a national pride. It's an issue of national pride.
Right.
Speaking of Hebron, I want to say that we've been in the news a lot in the last few days. I mean, we are like the center of all news in the last few days. Why? Because we've had a few soldier to provocateur incidents.
Right.
We had one provocateur coming up to a soldier and bother him.
Right.
And bother him and bother him and push him, spit him.
Right, while he's on the job.
And the guy and the kid kept saying, the soldier who's 18 years old or 19, holding a gun, trying to keep the peace, putting his life on the line for the nation. And the guy was bothering him on video going like, you're Ben-Gvir's soldier, aren't you? You're just a fighter for, you're like a mercenary for Ben-Gvir. You want to do Ben-Gvir stuff. That's what you want to do. So then this kid goes, Ben-Gvir will come into power, and he's going to make Seder around here, and he'll take care of you. Okay, after being pushed
he'll
around.
He'll make Seder means he'll, like, put things in order.
Put things in order and make order out of your provocations. So that was caught on video. It was put out in the press. This kid got 10 days in the Army Slammer.
I wonder what that's like in there. Do you think it's bad?
No, it's not bad.
Maybe it's kind of like a vacation a little bit. Like 10 days vacation for you, son.
It is. And
you don't have to stand duty. You just eat your meals, learn some Torah.
But once again, do you know what came to the rescue?
What?
Social media. There are times where I'm like, you social media are something else.
Why?
Because the Israeli people were just like, no, 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 no. Our boys are defending our land. They're standing up to these Euro paid bastards. Okay, oops, delete. They're standing up to these Euro paid activists, and the kid didn't do anything wrong at all. He just said a little phrase, but big deal. It's the Middle East around here. You know what I mean? People throw words around sometimes. Big deal. Like, who cares? This is not something punishable. Anyway, this made such a stir on the internet that, like, they're reconvening to, like...
Even the chief, IDF chief of staff, General Kohavi, made a statement about it.
Yeah, he made it.
He defended the officer who decided that he's going to go to jail. But nonetheless, he was forced to comment on it, that the whole nation was in such an uproar over this story that he had to say something.
The army does not belong to the people. Oh, scratch that. The army belongs to the people.
Well, you know, it does belong to the people, but at this, it does belong
it's
to the people, but it also,
it's our
there
sons
are generals
that we're
yes.
putting into this fight. And they're
yeah,
they're
but not you don't get to you don't get to make phone calls and tell the sons and daughters
no,
what
you don't
to do.
Get
there's,
to make...
there's officers and there's yeah. higher officers all the way up to
Maka,
the IDF chief of
Maka,
staff.
Just you're right yes. everything you're saying. But remember the average people that are sending their kids
right.
to the front lines, for God's sakes, and they don't need our army to be throwing our kids into jail
right.
for what?
Right, for speaking rudely.
Yeah, and for pushing back on this guy. Right. Anyways, that was story number one. Story number two.
Speaking rudely gets you put in jail, by the way.
It was, and who was I talking with? Oh, my gosh. Who was I talking with? I was talking with somebody funny who said to me, had he only said, let's see what he have said. Lapid's going to come into office.
Yeah, mamash.
And make order out of the situation. Yeah. Would he have faced
no
one day jail?
Gone to jail?
Exactly.
Interesting.
Who told me that?
That's a good one.
I was at a big gathering yesterday of smart nationalist right-wing thinkers. So somebody funny like that told me that yesterday. I just can't place it right now. I'll get to that in a second. Anyway, there was another incident. This one a little bit more aggressive
yep.
where this provocateur
yep.
provoking
yes.
provocations was in Hebron. Bothering another Givati soldier. It might have been in a similar incident, but anyway, they tried to hold him or arrest him, and he like escaped arrest. He got out of the hold.
Right.
And so the soldier grabbed him, knocked him down, and gave him a big punch right to the head, side of the head. This one was a little bit more active. But again, the counterclaim is, why is the police and et cetera allowing these provocateurs to come into town and bother our soldiers? Now, I was speaking to some political class people here in Israel, and I was saying to them, if this was America and you tried to resist arrest.
Right. No one would have a lot of questions.
Holy
moly.
Well,
no, that's not exactly true. Even in America, there's a lot more, the word is bikoret. There's a lot more critical eye placed on.
Yeah.
Policing.
You try to escape arrest.
Yeah, try to escape
they
arrest.
They will tase.
Yeah, your face will be, you'll be eating dirt.
You'll be eating dirt and your body will be convulsing in a, when 10,000 volts go through. Okay, forget about it. Like what a joke. These, and again, we have our, now I'm not justifying or excusing the act, and I'm not sure what the situation was to justify or excuse it. So I'm not condemning it either. Okay. You know what I mean? People came to provoke our soldiers to fight with them, and scuffle ensued. That's what are our soldiers? At the end, they are a force of defense. And I'm going to say something that people don't like to hear. People like to talk about moral army, but I'm going to say something different. You know what an army is? It's organized use of force. It is a machine of controlled violence. That's what it is. It's a machine that answers violence with superior violence. That's what it is. That's what they're taught. That's what they're armed for. That's why they're wearing knee braces and a vest and have a gun and have a helmet, because they're there to engage violence and to return violence with superior violence. That's what it is. It's a muscle of pushing back on bad guys. So okay, you know what I mean? What do you think soldiers are going to do when you push them to the edge? What do you think they're going to be like well-mannered, British police officers, bubbies, whatever they're called over there? Anyway, so that's what happens.
Bubbies or grandmothers? You confused me for a second.
Bubby?
Like bubbies?
No, not bubbies.
Like a whole bunch of grandmas?
Grandmas, you don't want that. You don't want that.
I think you meant bobbies.
No, bobbies. I'm sorry, but I don't know what
not bubbies.
It's a very fine accent for it. I was trying to make a British accent on Bobby.
I'm like, a lot of bubbies.
Not a lot of bubbies.
No, that's not what he
means. You know what? You know what? You give some of those clubs to some of those bubbies.
Yeah, they'll go down. They'll go down to Chinatown on you.
That's
yes.
Right. They'll take care of business. All right. So that was another issue. Oh God, what else?
Should we talk about our Shabbat that we had this week?
Well, this last Shabbat we had that Thanksgiving Shabbat, yes. And I promised our listeners that anybody who wanted to donate to our Kiddush would get blessings.
Yes.
Thanksgiving Achieved. Blessings. That's right. There was two. There was Krista, who I said from the get-go she was going to get that. She was going to get, you know, part of that those efforts of blessings. And there was my buddy Jack.
Yes. Yeah, so we openly and at lengthy words.
Yes.
Bless them and wish them the very, very best of health and happiness and prosperity and every kind of good thing over our Shabbos food. And we got a wonderful package from Chaim.
At Prohibition Pickle.
Who made a delicious array of yum-yums for us for our Kiddush, and we had a really good time. And of course, we made Thanksgiving-themed foods. Now, this is a big machloket, a big controversy.
Wait. Before you go on to the foods, we're going to do it right now.
Yeah.
I just want to say that Jack also asked me to also pray for the United States of America.
Well, that's nice.
So I prayed and blessed the good side of the United States of America, the good forces, the good angels, and the good people. And the good ideas.
Right. Well, they're fighting their own good fight over there in the United States. And it might not be our fight. But I think that the fight of all good peoples around the world is interconnected. I really feel that way. And, you know, here in Israel, we're really looking, of course, at the fight that's going on in Iran. We're looking at the fight that's going on in China.
That's right.
And these struggles are something that we can also very much identify with. And we really send like our most heartfelt and as powerful as possible blessings to all those people who are struggling for goodness and decency and a good life and good values and normalcy and freedom. You know, wherever you are.
Do you know what the symbol of the Chinese struggle is?
No.
I love this. It's sometimes people are so brilliant out there. Their symbol of the struggle is a blank white piece of paper. Just a blank white piece of paper. You are silencing me, and this is what I can say.
Interesting.
Out here. And they're just they're taking up these pictures of these blank white piece of paper, and that's like the sign of the protest.
Mm.
I love it.
I mean, they're so brave. You know, here in Israel, you were just talking about our fight about whether it's considered okay or not okay to speak rudely to a provocateur. And, you know, we have our struggles in here when we deal with terrorism that's so real. And, you know, our kids were just talking to us about like how some fears have been creeping up in them a little bit, the intensity of life. I did not grow up with that. And you spent a lot of years in America, Yisha. I'm not sure you grew up with that. It's like that feeling of like being in danger. That's not a feeling that I had as a child.
I just want to say
that it's very, very real. But at least you have the freedom to talk about it.
Right.
Right?
Right.
At least you can be like, Kochavi, I like what you said. Kochavi, I don't like what you said. Netanyahu, I don't like what you said. Netanyahu, I do like. In China, they can't do that. In Iran, they can't do that. They literally can't express what they think.
On our very street here, there's a house that is being worked on by a lot of Arabs.
Yeah.
And our daughter told me, she's like, I have changed my walking route and stuff like that.
Right, to not walk next to them.
Yeah, because I feel like
the guard is not such a fantastic guard.
Yeah, and there's like, they're just giving off an energy of like.
Right, bad energy.
Bad energy. And not all Arabs, I'm not accusing all Arabs of that, but I'm saying, you know, specifically here, like there's definitely like a discomfort, especially with these attacks. In Iran, 4 people are now sentenced to die because they're supposedly, quote unquote, Israeli spies. I have no idea if that's true or not, but the Iranian regime and the Chinese regime are cracking down on the people. I a little bit wish that Israelis would go to march to protest for them.
Right.
Like I a little bit in my heart feel like I sometimes feel like we're liberal where you don't need to be liberal and we're not liberal where you need to be liberal. It's like where's our identification with these global struggles. Like in my heart, I'm a lot of times like, I was in JCPenney.
Yes.
in Florida.
Where's this going? Yeah.
And there was this lady who was helping me. Her name was Ashrat. And I said to her, that's like our Hebrew Ashrat. She's like, yes, it is like it. And she was a Persian, Iranian, non-Jew.
Yeah.
Since she was living in South Florida, she was partially Jewish.
Just by
being
osmosis,
there.
Osmosis, yeah.
But she was Jewish in the sense that she is a classic Iranian who feels a kinship to Israel. And
she's not Jewish. She's like an ancient peoples.
Ancient peoples. Persian, Iranian people who are normally pro-Israel. And she started telling me all about the protests that they're fighting and all about the... And I'm thinking to myself, like, sheesh, like, why we don't hear more about that? And then I think about the press that wants to fight all day long with Israel's development. And I'm thinking, there are people that are freaking being killed. Wait a minute. Yeah. There are people who are being killed on the streets of Iran, Tehran. Yeah. And in China, and they're standing up to this oppression. And I just feel like we're just like...
So here's what I'm saying. Let's make a commitment, Blee Netter, but let's make a commitment, you and me, to at least be posting like once a week, or maybe one more than that. But let's be committed to like posting something on our social media about these things.
Let's do it.
Okay.
I like that.
Not everything has to be about what's going on inside internally here in Israel.
No, but it has everything to do with it. It has everything to do with oppressive forces. I'm going to go left on this whole thing. It has something. What is that called when all things are tied into one another? What's the?
wait. Intersectionality.
Intersectionality. That's right. Yeah, we got our own intersectionality. Here's my intersectionality. Nationalist peoples. People who believe in the right of self-determination of ancient peoples on their ancestral homeland stand together. People who believe in anti-jihadism stand together. People who believe in family values stand together. People who believe there's a God in this world stand together. People who want to push back on oppression and cruelty in these giant countries with these minorities choking people, keeping them down, we stand together. Yes, there's intersectionality between us, anti-jihadists here in Israel, and anti the CCCP, and anti the Mullah regime in Iran. Yes, there is an intersectionality. It is our business, especially the Iran one for sure. The Iran one for sure. That one, and the China one also has a lot to do with this. Because they put, by the way, you know another group of people? There's one more that bothers me endlessly. You know what bothers me? Taiwan. I'm like, why is Israel not standing more
that
with Taiwan?
That one's going to be tough. That's why.
Right, right. And
that one's very tough.
I asked a smart dude yesterday. I said, why isn't Israel standing more with Taiwan? We got the same situation. So what happened? Earlier this week, I was walking next to the Tomb of the Patriarchs and Matrix, and there was a group from the Abraham Hostel, and all kinds of people are there. And they asked me to speak to them for a few minutes. I spoke to them.
That's
so
nice.
There was a tall Chinese-American... American-Chinese, what's the right way to say it? I don't know.
Chinese-American.
Chinese-American. And she was from New Jersey, familiar for me. And she started asking me tough, you know, not tough for me, but like regular, you know.
Like the hard-hitting questions.
About our rights in this land. I said to her, Israel is like Taiwan. Do you think that maybe Taiwan should cut half of its island and give it to the CCCP to make peace? Do you think that that's going to, you know, calm everybody down? And I said that to her. She was like, oh, my. She just like totally stopped in her tracks. I'm like, we're a tiny island defending our rights against a huge conquest religion slash ethnic majority that wants to crush this ethnic minority's independence. She was just like, she totally like understood it completely better. I could see that she was a Chinese American whose parents were like, anti-communist China and, you know, always for the fighting for it. Suddenly I put it in a completely different context for her. But I don't know why Israel doesn't stand up more for Taiwan. I mean, and the answer is there are billions of dollars or yen of investments here in Israel from the Chinese government. Excuse me, yuan. Easy to get confused. In any case, Malka, by the way, how many one Chinese yuan equals half of an Israeli shekel? Did you know that?
I did not.
I didn't know that either. Just look that up right now. In any case, all right, Malka. So those are some of the issues there. I cut you off. You started talking about the Thanksgiving foods.
Well, we talked about more important things than my Thanksgiving foods.
Well, Malka, you know, some listeners want to hear about
it. I think I just want to talk about it because it was so good.
Go ahead.
And I'm a little bit mad now that all those foods are gone. I worked really hard. I had a whole plan. And some people think that it's wrong for Jews, or for especially for Israeli Jews, to be making a Thanksgiving, because they consider that a very like a westernization, that it's, you know, taking on like an American holiday. And you and I even have a disagreement, Ishai, as to what we're actually doing on Shabbat Thanksgiving. First of all, we're not really celebrating Thanksgiving. And secondly, we're certainly not doing it on Thanksgiving. We just, for me, I'm talking about myself now, I like Thanksgiving foods. I feel like I want to eat them. And I don't want to miss out on the most delicious meal of the year. And I can make it kosher. So that is what I am doing on right. Shabbat Thanksgiving. And we do go around and talk about what we're thankful for. You, on the other hand, feel that you are actually taking the American holiday of Thanksgiving and bringing it into your Shabbos.
I think that it is nice to sometimes at these opportunities to discuss where you came from. And I myself, being an immigrant to the United States when I was younger, when I was a kid, recognized the things that that country gave to me as I grew up, to be more Jewish, to be more worldly, to think about a better a system of governance. And I still think to this very day that the United States, some of the American ideas can be implemented here and done better. And in general, the very language that we're speaking in right now.
Yes.
And many of the thoughts inside of our heads come from that general culture. And I happen to be a kind of person who is related to Rabbi Yehuda ben Tema, who sees the good in the Roman Empire. And there are colleagues of mine who
are... Or more Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai.
More Shimon Bar Yochai in that sense. But I myself am more the kind that sees the...
You're a little bit of both. I don't know. I think on this one...
Okay.
I'm
saying specifically about this issue of seeing the good,
right,
the value of the thing. Because
we spend a lot of time on Rabbi Shimon type discussions. And the reality is that in terms of Israel's future, we know with absolute certainty that one of the most important things that Israel has to do is separate itself from foreign influence and become a country which stands on its own and which does not need even friendly allies or favorable empires to direct us or to guide us. We need to be making our decisions and become a leader on our own, become our own empire. And I know that you feel that way.
Absolutely. And I think that's well said. I think actually, when you like and respect this other thing, then you could be like, I like and respect and I take the best of you. And it's because I can be allied with you from a place of
strength.
Right, a place of strength and not a place of being a puppet. And that's actually comes from that. It's when you are not confident in your identity, when you need... Somebody said to me once, we Israelis need a big embrace from a power. And I said to him, and he means like it could be, you know, it could be a Soviet Union that was at the beginning of the state, or it could be the United States or France or whatever it was, or Britain at different periods. I said to him, yeah, we have a power that wants to give us a big embrace.
That's Hashem.
Yeah, you just got to embrace that power. That's all. You got to embrace it. You got to embrace the big power. I hope to call the name of the show that. Embrace the big power.
Oh, nice.
Malka, speaking of foods.
Wait, but we didn't even say what I made.
Go on now.
I made pumpkin pie.
Yes, you
did. It was really good.
Mm-hmm.
I made sweet potato pie. I made pecan pie, which was my favorite. Apple pie. Leia really made that one. I made stuffing that was actually really good. I made it from scratch out of bread. I made mashed potatoes,
which I liked.
I made sangria,
which was excellent.
Thank you.
Malka sangria. If you ever want a party, forget it. Nothing like Malka sangria. And there's nothing like Malka on sangria, but we shouldn't talk about it too much.
Yeah, we don't have to really talk about
that. But definitely Malka gets very happy.
I enjoy the sangria. I'm not a big drinker.
Yeah.
But I do like that sangria.
A little sangria. I think it should come out more often, personally, the sangria.
Well, Purim is coming.
That's right.
Kind of.
Hanukkah's coming. Is there a sangria?
There's not a sangria. It's more latkes, but that's the problem. I don't want people to come down on you hard, but like you're not a big latke lover.
There's a few Jewish foods that I can't eat. Latkes are one of them. I know.
So
I just heard.
Bad.
I heard a collective global,
like a krechts,
a global, like around the world.
People unsubscribed right now.
It's because it's like, it's too much oil for my liver. Just, I can't do it.
You transfer that hatred over to me and I will say, I love latkes.
I never said hatred.
But I like it with the sour cream.
Yeah. I need like non-oily latkes.
But you like souvganiyo.
Oh yeah, too much.
Those are pretty oily.
I can't explain
it.
There's something
about, I think maybe it's the potato.
Something to do with potato, the oil. It's too much for me. I also reject my own people's, the Russian people's beloved
salty fish.
Which
we had Russian like very honored Russian guests at our home
recently,
family friends, and my mother-in-law, your mom, gave me like money to make it good, right? To make the food extra special. So I went out and I bought like 5 or 6 kinds of salty fish, something I never buy because you don't eat it. And I like displayed it out on the table so nice, and I like laid it out in little circles and stuff. And I just saw your face. You're just like, what am I going to eat?
Yeah. And it got taken down.
It got taken down.
They take it down.
They loved it.
Oh my gosh.
With some pickles.
Maka, the last issue that I want to talk about food is that this Shabbat coming up, and I know you're not feeling 100%.
Yeah. I feel all right. It's just not 100%.
This show has brought out your bubbliness,
Thank
Malka.
You
are just...
Yeah, I'll just collapse after...
They don't call you Sangria Malka for nothing.
Do they?
Anyway, I want to say that this Shabbat coming up is the Shabbat Vayetze. And Shabbat Vayetze has one of the most iconoclastic and visual of all...
I don't think iconoclastic is a word that Jews use.
Whatever.
I think that iconoclast is like some kind of a not Jewish.
Jews don't even like the word iconic because of the word icon. But we know what we're talking about here. What we're talking about here is an image seared into the mind, an image that lives and should live more, in my opinion, in the hearts of Jews and all Bible lovers, and all lovers of God, and that is Jacob's dream of the ladder between heaven and earth.
Right.
And I now ask you, dear Malka, to make a challah.
Oh, gosh.
That is ladder-shaped.
Thanks for asking me to make the one thing that's like the hardest.
Or a
cake. Maybe I'll just like a little pretzel. Maybe I'll just arrange some pretzels in a ladder shape.
Whatever. Okay.
Maybe I'll make challah.
Malka, whatever you want to make is fine. I'm just saying.
No, maybe. Okay.
Saying,
challenge accepted, Blinetter.
You know, there's got to be a ladder.
I'm just scared, people. I'm not a good challah maker.
There is nothing deeper. Like, this is everybody's homework. And I remember that a few years ago, I asked you all to send me pictures of like a vision of a ladder that you have, a dream of a ladder.
I guess
ladder
a lot of people don't have that.
No, everybody sent to me. I had like 5, 6, 7, 8.
Oh, that's nice.
People kept sending me stuff. I had beautiful, beautiful pictures of ladder food and ladder things and the ladder between
celery
heaven and
sticks.
Earth. See, Malka, you're already thinking. That's wonderful. Okay, I'm saying the ladder between heaven and earth, its feet planted on the earth. And it's head in the heavens. This is the sign of every God-fearing person where we keep our feet on the ground, but our thoughts up in the heavens, and angels of God going up from the earth and down from the heavens, and that interconnection between heaven and earth. That's a vision of it all. That's the vision of it all, because that's really what we're doing here. We're establishing the connection. We're establishing the connection. That's our job. We're technicians. We're basically fiber optic technicians. We're trying to establish the connection between heaven and earth, and that's what it's about.
We're like internet providers.
Now, before the internet, it was more like biological kind of visuals. You know, like the Kabbalists saw Beit El as being the belly button where there was a umbilical cord between heaven and earth.
Oh, nice.
But today, I think we can look at it more in terms of packets and in terms of, digital information. So I'm saying that it's a very iconic moment. I want you guys to share with me your ladder. So write me an email. Send me your ladder, yishai@yishaifleischer.com. Send me, a picture of a food or a way that you've made the ladder part of your life. I remember, Malka, years ago, we lived in Beit El. And we once were at some store, and I saw that the Judaica store, and I saw that they were selling a yad, i.e. a Torah reading finger hand thing that
stick.
You hold, stick,
yeah.
And it was shaped in a ladder. And I remember
cool.
I bought two of them,
right.
and we
brought them back to Beit El.
Beit El, yeah, I remember that. Maybe you have a necklace with the ladder.
Nope. A necklace with a ladder.
Yeah, like a, like a little ladder thing. Little.
No, I don't.
I don't know. Okay, but, you know, we need the ladder in our life. That's what I'm saying. We need.
Okay, I'm gonna try for the challah.
Also, of course, known as the Stairway to Heaven.
Yeah,
I just made that up. Stairway to Heaven. Is
that cool? Play Led Zeppelin making your food for Shabbos, yeah, does that count?
If you go to the store and you're like, and you're checking out and you're getting ready for Shabbos and you're like, and she's buying a stairway to heaven.
You have to sing it at the people?
Yeah.
But you have to take a video of it.
Yeah, you have to take a video and it'll become viral. all right. So, okay. So that we talked about these issues. Very good, Malka. So Shabbat Shalom. Very exciting. Speaking of China, I want to do a shout out to my main man, Increase. Okay. My little brother. Living out in Spain right now, but he just sent me a beautiful picture of him with this poster that he made that has Israel and China. He comes from a Chinese background partially, and he's got his future home and his connection to Israel. And he sent me a beautiful picture. So my main man, Increase, I want to say God bless you and keep up the growing up awesomeness, and send me more pictures because they inspire. And may we see a healthier China and a stronger Israel in the future. And your good wishes and thoughts make all the difference. Speaking of young people, Malka, Hanukkah is coming.
Yes.
Hanukkah is coming. And so it's time to get ready for Hanukkah. And I'm sure that there's some great menu options at prohibitionpickle.co.il.
Yes. Ooh, I wonder what he's going to cook up over there.
I think he's going to have a special menu for Hanukkah, so get ready for that. And in fact, somebody wrote to me. So I got an email from Jamie, who says, hello from Washington State. I listen to your podcast religiously. I think he means that both ways. And I enjoy it very much. I have not reached out to you before, although I did talk to you on the phone when you called to talk about the Hebron Fund and my donations there.
Nice.
That's right. I love the land and the people of Israel as much as possible from my distant location. I believe I'm part of the International Torah Congregation.
That's awesome.
And I enjoy hearing your conversations with one and only Malka. I added the one and only. your perspective on current events in Israel, politics, your interviews, and Torah from the land of Israel. I'm a Gentile believer in the Christian faith, and I keep all my applicable Torah commandments the best way I can. I guess you could say I'm a follower of the way, as I believe early Christians would have been in the first century. My family and fellowship follow, that means my group, that's a special talk.
Like community. Community, spiritual exactly. Community.
I love that word, fellowship, love that word. My family and fellowship follow the Jewish calendar and celebrate the feast as best we can from where we are. I would love to be able to live in Israel someday, but I suspect that is not an option for me as a non-Jew. Perhaps you could let me know if I'm wrong. Well, the answer to that is, you know, maybe not to be necessarily a resident, but you could come.
I mean, I'm not advocating for this way of living necessarily, but I will say that there are people who come to Israel who are not Jews and who set up, I don't think they set up residency, but they come as, they come and work.
The simplest thing of them all is come for vacation for 2-3 weeks, right, for a month or two. It's great. It's the way to do it. And first thing I want to just say before we even go on, I want to say thank you so much for this wonderful email, Jamie. And thank you for yearning to follow God more nearly. And I think that that's beautiful. And thank you for letting me be part, me and Malka and the rest of us be part of your life. And it's so moving to me. And it's amazing to me how people from faraway places who really don't need to be part of Israel at all are moved by the story of Israel, by the calendar thing touches my heart, just to live by the calendar. And I hope, Jamie, that this Shabbat you will be reading the Torah portion of Vayetze, about Jacob's sojourning and leaving of the land of Israel to go to Haran, but in the meantime, first to be with his head on the Temple Mount and to see that great ladder between heaven and earth. And I hope that you eat something or have something in your life that's going to be look like the ladder, remind us of that ladder. And thank you for that. But Jamie does not finish Maka. He also says, I would like to send you and your family a gift from Prohibition Pickle.
Aww.
I know I can order via their website. How can I make sure it's delivered to you? Just write Yishai. Believe me, Chaim knows exactly. Just go deliver to Yishai Fleischer and it'll be immediately there.
That's very nice of
you. That's very, very nice of you. Thank you very much. That's very kind of you. And of course, on the other side of the deal is, of course, blessings on Shabbat, on the
That's
Holy
right.
Shabbat. For friends throughout the world who are part of that. Blessings to you and your family, and I pray for
incidentally, people out there listening, we'll be happy to bless you at our Shabbat table anyway. Just without, yeah. without...
Oh, you send me...
Without a kiddush.
No.
You send us your name.
No, you gotta invest.
What do you mean?
You gotta send me a picture of yourself in your house with either the flag of Israel...
Okay, fine.
With a picture of yourself, with a picture of something of Israel in your life... With your favorite verse, you gotta send me something.
Okay, fine.
You want a blessing?
Yeah,
for
but
me?
I'm saying it doesn't have to be a thing where you open your wallet.
Absolutely not. But
although
gotta be,
that's very kind, and when people send us kiddush, it's fun.
But you gotta invest your time. I want to see your life. I want to see your dog wearing a State of Israel sweater. I want to see. You send me. I want you to hear your favorite verse. I want to hear something. I want to see you with a wine bottle from the land of Israel at your table. Okay, if you're living in Washington State, I want to see you with a Chevron wine on your table, right? Something like that. That's the only thing I ask for. That's the only thing I want. You send me your because I'll know then that you are out there, you know, spreading that light, and that you need to get sent that blessings, and you're reverting it back to me. All right, that's the simple investment I ask for. I make this show. You write me a little email with a picture. That's all I say. That's it. All right. Let me just finish that email up. And I say blessings to you and your family, and I pray for the peace of Jerusalem and all of Israel daily.
Thank you.
I know those prayers
so nice.
Are especially needed these days. I look forward to hearing from you soon. Thanks, Jamie. God bless
Jamie. That's so nice. It's so nice to hear from you.
And God bless all of our friends at the International Torah Community. And I want to thank also the Land of Israel Network that does such a great job, and especially Ari and Jeremy with their great fellowship, and Tehila and all those folks that do a great job of pushing out, and Shana, who push out such a great job of making the fellowship program. And I also want to thank our other sponsors. As I said, the Hebron Fund right now is having a cause match campaign.
Yes.
Where everything is matched. So please go to HebronFund.org. But before you just give there, look for my like team, because there's the Yishai team.
What
okay?
happens? Do you get like a free coffee or something if you win?
No, I get nothing. But we
you
have
get
a
clout.
Yeah, I get clout. That's
in
it.
The
exactly.
Office.
That's exactly it. That's exactly it. That's all we get out there. But that's something. You know, I also want to dedicate this show to my good friend Yehuda Cohen,
right?
Whose mother passed away, and there's a great he did a great writing on Instagram about his mom. So Rabbi Yehuda Cohen, his mom left this world for a better place, and we Chaya Bat David. We want to wish her her neshama on a continued aliyah and blessings to you, and blessings to you, our good friend Yehuda Cohen. We also want to talk about our good friends at Retro Watch Guy. I am already sporting my awesome Tissot.
Yes, you
and
love
it. I do love it, and I even made a special hanging place for it in my room because I wear it on Shabbats. I have my weekday watch, but now I have my Shabbat watch, and I like that a lot. And you could go to Retro Watch Guy, and I love also their awesome, awesome Instagram page. And right now on their Instagram page, they have some really cool stuff, especially this Neptune by Baylor super compressor dive ready to stuff a stocking. What does that mean? You know, listen, they got the holiday season out there. I personally prefer to wear stockings and not like hang them up.
Do you?
But...
Do you?
Well, I have those wool socks that I like.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have those wool socks. But in any case, this is a beautiful watch. Look at it, Maka. Look at this. That's cool.
That is cool. Shiny.
That's cool. And they've got... What else do you like, Maka? Do you like this one?
Let's see.
Hold on. I'm going to find one that you like. Here is a beautiful Hewer Carrera. Look at this beautiful. Do you like this one? What colors is that?
That looks like a...
What colors is that?
Kind of like a goldy... Like a gold. Goldy, bronzy, with a nice leather strap.
I got to find one that you like. But in any case, Maka, I want to wish everybody an opportunity to go to Retro Watch Guy. And it's really fun to...
Right, he has so many options and they look like really not just quality items, but also things which are at are in very good condition.
That's right. And if you just put in coupon code Yishai, bang.
Bang.
10% off right there. 10% off. Oh, and if you put on Prohibition Pickle coupon code Yishai, you get 7% off. Okay, so don't forget to...
Wow. You know,
yeah, that's right. That's a lot. That's a lot of money. That's a lot of money over there. And so we have the Hebron Fund. We have Retro Watch Guy. We have Prohibition Pickle. And we have, of course, the Israel Bible. The Israel Bible is a way to have a great, beautiful Bible in your house that has Hebrew, English, has beautiful pages, beautiful fonts, a beautiful translation, beautiful transliteration, and beautiful commentary specifically about the land of Israel, edited by my friend Rabbi Tuli Weiss. You can have one in your house. It's got a great cover, too. Whenever I go into like a Knesset office and I see that Bible, that specific Bible, it's made by the Koren company.
Do you see it a lot in the Knesset?
I see it. I see it in a few places, and I'm like, bang, look at that.
Bang.
That's nice. And, of course, if you type in coupon code Yishai, once again, you know about that. So 10% off God's holy word. It's just that simple and awesome. Finally, I want to thank the good friends in the press today. I wanted to talk about how bad the press is, and I have a whole thing to talk about.
I'm sure we'll be able to bring that up again.
Yeah, there'll be more opportunities, but there's a lot of evil lies, an upside down world of lies in the press out there. And to counteract that, there's a few good press options. There's Israel National News, Arutz Sheva, for me, practically indispensable. There's JNS.org, which we're partnered with. They do great stuff. There's Israel 365 for a more biblical perspective of the news. And there's also JewishPress.com that puts out our show every single week. So check out these news sites. JewishPress.com does a great job of putting an email into your inbox with all the news that you need to know. And they do a great job. By the way, completely not a sponsor of the show by any measure, but I found that the Daily Wire has got a newscast, a once-a-week newscast, like the morning news with Daily Wire. I find it to be excellent and really gives me a perspective on what's going on. So there's really so important to support good media, because the bad media is supported by the worst people, and they're out there brainwashing our youth and trying to erase the truth. I'm telling you, I myself deal with it all the time. So support good media, because it makes all the difference. And it's not the easiest. Oh, by the way, last week's word, I got a lot of emails. People were like, you're stuck in a word. That word was ember.
Yes.
It was ember.
Which word would you like to be stuck on this week?
The word of like a group of businesses, like a like a...
Alliance?
No.
Like the airplane guys? What's it called? The Five Star Alliance?
No, not an alliance. Like the automobile business. What's it called? The
union?
No, Malka, no, not a you. I'm not talking about like an alliance of people. Sure. I'm saying a word that says that whole
industry.
That's the word I was looking for. Thank you. So the industry of press is a tough one. So supporting it is very, very important. All right, folks, we've been here for quite a bit together. Malka, I want to thank you very much for bearing with me, and also for being on the show today.
Yes.
I can't wait to have that ladder yum-yums that you can figure out.
Okay, I'm going to make Emir Tashem the ladder challah.
That sounds really good, okay?
If any of you have a good challah recipe that doesn't involve a mixer or like weird things like bread gluten or like fancy things like that, I would love a good challah recipe.
All right. Well, that's easy to get to you, Malka. If people write me an email, yishai@yishaifleish.com. I want to also recommend that you check out buymeacoffee.com/Yishai. Great way to support the show. And of course, if you want to support our projects of beautification and other projects in the land of Israel, check out yishaifleish.com with all of our shows. Send that to friends. That way they can connect. And great donate page as well. That's it. I want to thank you, Malka. God bless you, folks. More great stuff is on the way. Stay tuned, stay strong, stay connected.
Shalom.
And shalom.
Yishai needs coffee. Please help support the show by buying Yishai coffee at buymeacoffee.com/Yishai. Thank you and l'chaim. Don't worry, the Yishai Fleisher show will be right back, so stay tuned.
All right, folks, you are listening to the Yishai Fleisher Show. Great to be back with you. And I have a very special segment to play. Last week, I mean, I guess 2 weeks ago, I recorded a segment with the famous, renowned podcast and show called Behind the Bima with Rabbi Ephraim Goldberg and Rabbi Josh Brody. And it was a great pleasure. And we talked about all the stuff that's important about Chai Sara, about Chevron,
about Itamar Ben-Gvir and about my understanding of issues pertaining to American Jewish Aliyah immigration to Israel, and how basically the American Jewish connection to Israel and to Israelis and how we should relate to one another. And so it was really, really fun, and I've gotten a lot of feedback from their show, but I wanted to put up a little bit of a shortened version of that discussion for folks that that don't know that show, which I do recommend you check out. That's called Behind the Bima. The Bima is the prayer desk, a prayer table that sits at the center or in the front of Jewish synagogues. And Behind the Bima means from the rabbi's perspective. So check that out. Check out their podcast. It's really great. Rabbi Ephraim Goldberg is the head rabbi of the famous BRS Boca Raton Synagogue, and happens to also be a former classmate of mine, or a schoolmate of mine, more correctly, and a real strong leader of American Jewry. So check out the Behind the Bima podcast. But today, here's my discussion with Rabbi Goldberg and Rabbi Brody about all the issues that I talked about, and I'd love to hear your feedback. So write me an email, yishai@yishaifleisher.com, and let's go Behind the Bima.
We are honored and privileged to be joined by an old friend of mine, not old of his age, but old how far back we go, Yishai Fleisher, the spokesperson for the Jewish community of Hebron, advocate for Aliyah, a fighter at the front lines for the Jewish people and the state of Israel. Yishai, thanks for going Behind the Bima together with us.
What an honor and a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Wow. So Yishai, there's so much to talk about. We want to hear about, we just came off of Shabbos Chayei Sarah, this parsha, of course, the parsha in which the Torah testifies that this land is ours. Avram purchased it. He overpaid for it because it was so valuable. I want to hear about how many people were there and what it was like. I want to talk about your childhood and your upbringing, where we overlapped and how you ended up doing what you're doing. But let's go right to the following question on a lot of people's minds. How many Jews live in Hebron today?
We have almost 100 families. Let's call it, together with the yeshiva, which has 300 students, we like to say that we have about 1,000 people living in Hebron. It's a little less than that. 1,000 Jews live in Hebron, but we also have our sister community of Kiryat Arba, which has about 9,000 people. So we're a block of 10,000 Jews in Kiryat Arba, Hebron. And Hebron proper, the Arab city of Hebron, numbers about 200,000 Arabs. So
great.
It's about 200,000 Arabs and 10,000 Jews.
That's the opening question. 10,000 Jews, 1,000 in Hebron, surrounded by 200,000, and I'd love to hear more from you and learn more from you about this in terms of the relations and how many really don't want us there or are okay with having us there. I'm not asking because I believe this. You know me well enough, and my audience knows me well enough to know this. I'm asking because this is what we sometimes hear. Yishai, why are we spending the money we're spending? Why are we risking the lives we're risking? The army, the police, security, security paraphernalia, military. Why are we doing all that for 1,000 Jews in Hebron? Okay, maybe right. 9,000. I don't know what the critical number is. Maybe Kiryat Arba hits it. Maybe in combination they hit it. But why is Hebron so important? Why are we spending all of this and risking all of that? And in fact, losing lives. Lo aleinu rachman al etzlan. Tragically, we've lost people in Hebron. Is it responsible for someone to live there with their family? What makes it worth it?
Okay, so I think there's at least three very solid answers to that question. The first one is that if you sit on the beach in Tel Aviv, and you're drinking a beer and just lay back in that beach chair, every 30 minutes, a helicopter gunship will just fly right in front of you. The same thing is true in the Jordan Valley. Same thing is true in Eilat. Same thing is true in the Golan Heights. Same thing is true in the Galil. In other words, our country is militarized. We are a defended post-Holocaust country, and we're an armed minority in our region. And therefore, we live wherever we live with surrounded by our army and police to make sure that we're safe. And the same thing is every mall that you go into Israel. When I come to America and I go into a mall and I just walk in without somebody checking my stuff or my gun license or my bag, I'm like, hey, where's the guard? You know, we live in a defended, militarized society because, again, we're post-Holocaust and we live in a place that has hostility towards us and has had many wars with an effort to annihilate us. That we've been through and terrorism, et cetera. Hebron happens to be a tad more militarized, a tad more defended, but that's just because there's a small amount of Jews there. We were kicked out. We were destroyed, basically, in 1929. The most ancient of all Jewish communities was destroyed in the 1929 riots when 67 Jews were murdered, and the British that were in charge basically kicked us out. And we only came back in 1967. Now, after the Six-Day War. Now, our country is a tad ambivalent about the right of Jews to settle Hebron or the importance of it. So there, the country has been a little bit like wishy-washy, a little ambivalent. But the Jews that have historical consciousness know that Hebron is key to the assertion of our historical and religious rights. If we abdicate that historic right of Jews to live in Hebron, we basically undermine one of the pillars of Zionism, which is our historical connection to the land, and then we will undermine our connection to Tel Aviv or any other seemingly safe place. But we've all discussed that gunships defend Tel Aviv as well. And lastly, I'll say to you that the 1,000 Jews that live in Hebron are not just 1,000 Jews. In truth, we have about 1 million visitors a year. We keep that place open for about 1 million visitors, mostly Jewish, but also Christian and Muslim visitors. People around the world know the importance of Hebron. People who have historical and Tanakh biblical consciousness know the importance of the place. And we have there the founding site of Abraham's first purchase in the land of Israel and the burial of our fathers and mothers, the burial tomb of the founders of our peoplehood. And so we cannot leave it. We cannot abdicate it. We need to hold on to it for all those things. Lastly, if we gave up Hebron, it would become just what happened in Gaza, which it would become Hamas land. It's mostly a Hamas city right now. And if you gave it up, you basically would allow rockets to enter it. And just on a security principle, you would be abdicating the security of Jerusalem to the jihad and allow it to become filled with rockets. So for all those reasons, for you know the fact that we have a historical connection to it, the fact that everywhere in Israel is security, the fact that the foundation of our history and our peoplehood is there, and that we don't want to give up the security of Jerusalem by giving up Hebron, for all those reasons, Jews live there. And of course, the 1 million tourists that come a year, every single year.
Those are great reasons. For all those reasons, you're in. Those are great reasons. And I find them compelling. I'm curious, a secular soldier who's asked to guard Hebron, who's there at the front line, rocks are being thrown, has to be in an armored vehicle, maybe, God forbid, is going to take a car ramming or attempted stabbing. Do those reasons suffice for that secular soldier? Do they say, you know what, that makes sense, that's compelling, I'm happy and I'm honored to serve? They have to serve, otherwise an army, of course, that disobeys, you've got problems. But does the secular soldier who may not buy the religious tie or connection to the land, may not even subscribe any longer to the Zionist connection to the land, but in terms of the security connection of defending Yerushalayim, or in terms of, do they buy it?
Today's soldiers are people that enter the fighting ranks by choice. You really have many ways to be out of the fighting ranks if you so choose. If you want to be a fighting soldier, then you basically know what you're getting into. So we find that soldiers are there besimcha, with joy. They like the interchange with people. They like the action, some of them. And some of them just like the fact that they're, instead of just driving around and defend the jeeps, they get to be with people, with children, with interchange every single day. Throughout their time in Hebron, we do our best to shower them with love and with lots of barbecues and with lots of, you know, fleeces and fun stuff. And we try to make it that the opportunity of having a secular soldier in our midst is an opportunity to educate and to bring him or her into the fold. The experience that most soldiers have, and it's been brought out through when you ask people what they think,
surveys,
right? Is that the soldiers do very much enjoy their time in Hebron, but it is also challenging. Some of them actually are despondent, not because of serving in Hebron or because they have to defend this religious site, so-called. They're actually disappointed when our own army doesn't let them react with the full measure that, you know, of justice against people who embarrass our army, who throw rocks at them, and, you know, they shoot back, you know, rubber bullets and stuff like that. And sometimes they get, like, upset that we're not giving a stronger response. I have heard soldiers say to me that I have lost some national pride serving in Hebron and being under attack and not being able to respond.
You've seen them change their politics? Yeah. They've changed their political orientation after serving in Hebron?
The soldiers see the reality. And therefore, it is a statistical fact that Israeli soldiers tend to the so-called right in Israel. Again, maybe it's a self-selecting group that wants to be a fighting soldier, and there's plenty of also religious soldiers amongst them. So it's a self-selecting group, and they tend to be more, you know, patriotic and strong and fighting type. But certainly, you cannot pull the wool over their eyes and tell them that the when they look at the huge Arab Hebron, 97% of which Jews are not allowed in, and it is one of the richest Arab cities in this region. It's probably the richest city from here to Riyadh, and certainly to the Persian Gulf. It's a very wealthy Arab city, and they see how big it is, how lively it is, how vibrant it is. And then they see the left tour people around and say to them, look, the Palestinians are abused because they can't walk in total freedom in this one little Jewish ghetto street. The soldiers just roll their eyes and are just like, come on, you know, we know the truth. So they see the truth for what it is. There are sometimes soldiers that are disappointed in the friction. There are more, you know, gentle souls that are sometimes, you know, are like, why is there, you know, why does there need to be this friction between Jews and Arabs? But most really do see the truth, which is that Jews need to be defended in this place. And if the army wasn't there, basically we would have another pogrom like we did in 1929.
We're thrilled that you're there. I've been there with my family. My daughter, Tamar, was just there. Her Hadar 12th grade class was just in Israel for the 12th graders always go. And I know Katz Hillel Day School goes to Israel and Hebron, you know, for us, thank God. You enable us to be able to go to Maras HaMachpelah, to be able to still continue to be at one of those, the first holy place for our people. So I was asking to hear you formulate, but of course we are beyond grateful. Rabbi Brody.
Yeah, I'm just wondering the other side. You know, you're talking about the secular Israeli that might not understand the significance. What about the Muslim who's religious and they have the same Bible where they're looking inside and they see the story of Avram, they see the story of Sarah. You could argue about the Temple Mount. I mean, we're not going to argue about it. We understand that it's that's got historical significance. They could say it's got nothing or there's no traces of a history there. But here you open the Chumash and you see Hebron, it was purchased. What do they do with this story if they really do believe it?
Rabbi Brody, let me a tad correct you. In the Muslim tradition, they don't look at our Torah as a valuable text. Okay. That's in the Christian tradition. They're like, that's the Old Testament, so-called. In the Islamic tradition, they understand our Torah to be somehow warped, and the Quran is the correct text. Now, in the Quran, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob were important people, but they were great Muslim prophets. And so was King David. And so were the women that are buried at Maras HaMachpelah. They were great Muslim prophets. And so that's how they get around that problem. It's their place as opposed to our place. However, it is interesting that the Muslims do not dispute that it's Abraham and Sarah, Isaac and Rebekah, Jacob and Leah who are buried at Maras HaMachpelah, the tomb of the patriarchs and matriarchs. They do not dispute that. And in fact, Christendom also doesn't dispute that. So basically, you have billions of people in this world who all agree, because there are some places that are disputed. For example, the tomb of Rachel, the great historian Yasser Arafat claimed that it is, in fact, the tomb of Bilal bin Rabbah, which is one of the helpers of Muhammad, who never visited Eretz Yisrael, the Holy Land, but in order to claim that it's their property, not our property in Bethlehem, Yasser Arafat invented this claim. When it comes to Maras HaMachpelah, interestingly enough, nobody ever debates who's buried there. They just debate whose it is. So therefore, the way that they do it, the Muslims today, not all the Muslims, but those Muslims who fight us for control, they call it the Ibrahimi Mosque, right? Haram al-Ibrahimi. So therefore, they say it's a mosque, it's their place. Interestingly, they pray today in what was originally built as a Byzantine church, a building on top or inside of the Herodian structure in Maras HaMachpelah. Basically, the structure that we know today was built 2,000 years ago by Herod, and about 1,500 years ago, the Byzantines built a church atop of that building because it was so massive. And then it was taken over by the Muslims, then it was taken over by the Christians, then taken over by the Muslims and held that way till today.
Tell us what it's like with the Muslim neighbors. There are 1,000 Jews in Hebron, 10,000 if you include Kiryat Arba. It's, as you said, a very hostile region, a very hostile neighborhood. I know you need a lot of protection to go visit. If you don't need it, you're given the impression that you need it, and people go without it, whether you really need it or not. Is there a subtext, a sub-story that's not told often enough about positive or warm relations? You as a spokesperson or some of the leaders of Hebron, are there friendships? Do you sit down and break pita? Do you sip tea? Are there relationships with leaders that maybe, you know, wouldn't play on TV because, you know, sort of man bites dog is what makes news, not dog bites man. So it's much more to talk about conflict than peace. Is there any hope, any optimism, anything that we should look towards to see as a positive sign?
First thing is that I want to just make sure that people know that you could take the 381 or 383 bus every hour from the central bus station in Jerusalem and come to Maratha Machpelah. That's why we have a million visitors a year. We have recently a whole load of Koreans, Russian Eastern Orthodox folks, certainly Jews from America. And every day, Sephardi grandmas get off the bus and say Tehillim at the Tomb of the Patriarchs and Matrix. I'm only saying that to say that, like, we shouldn't be scared of coming there. People are coming every single day. And the narrative of fear is a narrative that's created by our enemies in order to make us afraid to come to these places. If you are afraid to come to Maratha Machpelah, you have been terrorized because somebody struck terror into your heart in order to scare you, to keep you away. So we can't let them have that. And I'm just saying it is safe, it is welcoming, and it is open every single day. With regarding to dealing with the Arabs, we have no doubt we have enemies. For example, the mayor of the Palestinian-controlled city of Hebron is a guy by the name of Tiasir Abu Snena, who in 1980 was part of a group that shot and killed six Jews next to Beit Hadassah. And today he's the mayor. How do we know it's him? Because he runs on the campaign. Hey, look at me. I did that in 1980. Give me more power. Maybe I could do more good things. That's literally the campaign that he runs on. But on the other hand, we have neighbors like Haj Ashraf Jabri. And I made a few videos talking about that, who are literally interested in Jewish presence in this area, think it's historically just, believe that Israel is a far better sovereign than the corrupt and regressive Palestinian Authority. And one of the stories that I tell and he tells is that when my daughter Leah had her bat mitzvah right before Corona, my mom, who's a Russian Jew, said to me, can we have fireworks? Because we like fireworks, we're big smachot. And I was like, okay. So I, you know, checked with the local Jewish fireworks people, and it was expensive, and the army said no, and everybody said no. And a week before the bat mitzvah, my mom's like, what about the fireworks? And suddenly Hashem put a thought in my head, and I was like, wait a minute, why don't I just turn to the Arabs, my Arab friends who live behind Maratha Machpelah? They're always shooting fireworks, and nobody gives a darn. So what's the problem? So I called Ashraf Jabri, and I said to him, you know, Haj Ashraf, I said to him, can you shoot fireworks for my daughter's bat mitzvah? He's like, you want me to buy you some fireworks? I'm like, no, man. I need you to buy them. I need you to shoot them over the Maratha Machpelah at a certain time, at a prescribed date, prescribed time. Can you do it? And he said, you honor me by asking me to do such a thing, to be part of your simcha.
No permits required.
And that's right. No permits. Nobody cared. And so at 7 p.m. on that day, which happened to be Yud Aleph Cheshvan, the same day that the Rambam, Tet Cheshvan, the same day that the Rambam came and prayed at the Tomb of the Patriarchs and Matriarchs in the year 1165, that same very day, we came out of the Maratha Machpelah after my daughter Leah toured us inside the Maratha Machpelah, and exactly at 7, the sky lit up, and it was the most beautiful fireworks, and I was like laughing because it was so fun and beautiful, and everybody's like, Yishai, what a coincidence, there's fireworks at your daughter's bat mitzvah, and I'm like, no, I arranged it. And people are like, no, you didn't. And in fact, that's what happened. And I tell the story, and he tells the story as a matter of pride. So we do have some interchanges. We try to beef up those relationships. It's not easy. It's not easy for Arabs to be pro-Israel because they are under watch all the time. And the Hamas or the PLO will come knocking at their doors and saying to them, why are you good to these Yehud or these Mustautin, the settlers? And they are always under fire for any decent relations with us, but we try to push it forward. And we believe that if the state of Israel was less ambivalent and more clear-eyed about our rights and more assertive about our rights in Hebron, then more Arabs would come in line and have good relations with us.
Give us a quick synopsis. Shabbos Chai Sarah, how many people were there? Where do they stay and sleep? During Corona, was it on break? Was this the first time back since Corona or through Corona? You did it anyway. Give us a little overview of what it's like. For years, we've talked about we got to bring a Chevra, Shabbos Chai Sarah, and go to Hebron. That's a time to be there. Give us a little taste of what that's like.
I can give you a taste, but I'll tell you honestly, it's very hard to pass over what transpires. It's about 40,000 Jews that show up in Hebron for a Woodstock-style festival over Shabbos. There's just nothing like that in the world. There's just nothing like it. You just, there's tents everywhere. Now it's also caravans, these, what do you call them, these mobile like homes, these caravans come in. And people stay every nook and cranny that they could find, every piece of grass, every place that they could park a tent. And in Kiryat Arba, Kiryat Arba is completely packed full of folks. And then Friday night, a massive, unbelievable gathering at the Marat HaMachpelah, at the Tomb of the Patriarchs, the Matriarchs. And then afterwards, eating and drinking and singing, and the Sfaradim do bakashot, and then people giving out shalom for free. And the whole thing is like a Lag BaOmer, Uman, all rolled up into Shabbos in Judea and Samaria, in Hebron, you know, with an Arab city all around us and Allahu Akbar. It's like, it's a crazy thing. The tons of army, tons of folks. And then the most moving part of it all, I think, is Shabbat morning. And I can tell you, I wasn't there at Vatikin. I wasn't there at the early prayer. But 5:15 in the morning, it was totally packed. Now, the Tomb of the Machpelah, the Tomb of the Patriarchs and Matriarchs, is today split in half, so that there's a Muslim side and a Jewish side. But 10 days a year, 10 non-sequential days a year, the Arabs have full control of the Marat HaMachpelah, and 10 non-sequential days a year, we have full control of the Marat HaMachpelah. Shabbat Chai Sarah is one of those days where we have full control. So therefore, the big Isaac and Rebecca Hall is open, and it was packed full of people praying at 5:15 in the morning. I prayed later, like more like 9:15, but like, don't tell anybody. But anyway, the most moving part of it all is to read about the purchase of Marat HaMachpelah at the place. I mean, talk about organic. It's like the ground below, the tomb is right before you, the forefathers and mothers, you are the Jew, the children of these people, reading the ancient Torah, looking at the God above, and it's just a total like organic sensation of like, wow, it's this is the place. It just sends shudders through you. And then to read about how Rivka comes from Haran, from up there in southern Turkey, and comes down to meet Yitzchak at the field, you know, and Chazal tells us it's this field of Machpelah. What can I tell you? It's a love affair, and there's nothing like it in the world. And I really extend my invitation to both of you. You know, next year, Shana Ba B'Chevron, Bezrat Hashem, we'd love to host you. And you don't have to bring a tent. The Hebron Fund will make sure to keep you comfortable, as comfortable as we can in Hebron.
We appreciate that. You know,
yeah, we're going to come, in with our caravan.
It's a sort of combination. And it made me think that, you know, when we think about Shabbos Chai Sarah and Hebron, you think about safety and security from the Arab neighbors. But after Meron, we learned that safety and security can be a challenge just from stampedes and numbers and volume. How does that get managed? Is that a big concern? What's done now to help make sure that the flow of traffic and spacing, and that it's a safe environment for everyone?
Absolutely. I can't tell you how much effort. You just talked about safety, but I'll talk to you about something that we debate and discuss endlessly. Bathrooms. We need lots of bathrooms. We need lots of garbage cans. We need lots of policing, making sure that there's no abuse, because in such situations, 40,000 people. And in fact, we do have some security problems, not so much from Arabs, but from 10 drunk Jews who just make a lot of trouble. So we have that sometimes. And so we have to deal with a lot of logistics. You're absolutely right. Now, the building is very sturdy, and the avenues are relatively wide, so we don't have the situation that you had in Meron. There's no like bridges built and anything like that. It's all on the ground, so we don't have those problems. But yes, we have to make sure that there's no crushing, and we employ lots of people, and we do lots to bring bathrooms, garbage cans, security, army. Transportation is a tricky problem because getting into Hebron is not exactly so simple, just physically, logistically. So we, for example, we have, you know, like in Meron, we have a one-way bus system, like a circle that they come in, drop people off and leave. And Saturday night, we didn't let private cars leave till 2 hours after Shabbat so that all the buses could take people. There's really lots of logistics. For us, we say, we have a little joke inside the office. We call it Acharei HaChagim, which is a famous phrase in Israel, which means after the holidays, like banks stop working and like towards Rosh Hashanah, they're like Acharei HaChagim. So we say Acharei HaChagim for us goes a few more weeks after Sukkot to Chai Sara. I got to tell you, I have a tremendous weight lifted off my shoulders after Chai Sara. And on top of all that, people like myself are also concerned with bringing VIPs in, bringing speakers. We had Jonathan Pollard this year, and we had him speak. We have Rabbi Shmuel Eliyahu speak. Last year, we had my good friend Zvi Yechezkeli, very famous Israeli commentator, speak. We always bring VIPs, so that's housing them and bringing them in, the whole thing. So it's a big headache, and it's one of the most special things. Again, it's like a festival that is. By the way, it started as a political protest against Netanyahu in 1996 to not give away Hebron to the Palestinian Authority. That's how it started. Today, it's much more of a cultural heritage, spiritual gathering to really show our connection to our fathers and mothers in Hebron.
Hmm. Wow. Do people have to reserve? Like, how do you know how many people to anticipate?
The one thing that we do have to reserve, Chabad, and I must mention Chabad. Chabad, by the way, came to Hebron in the year 1807. And you can debate whether Chabad is Zionist or not Zionist. We can have a whole discussion about that. But if you ever want to evoke the more Zionistic style feelings out of Chabad, just mention Hebron. They are wild about Hebron. And our Chabad Shaliach, Danny Cohen, has basically instituted the largest Shabbat feeding tents in the world, and there's about 3,000 people. But it's not like when you have a tray and you pick up food. What's that called?
Cafeteria style.
Yeah, it's not cafeteria style. It's waiters.
These guys
China.
They know how to do it.
They put tents, and those tents have chandeliers, big pictures of the Rebbe, and so you do have to reserve that. That costs money. If you want to eat at the Chabad tents, then there's, you know, people like Baruch Marzel who give out cholent and stuff for free. And then there's the Hebron Fund, which is the fundraising arm of the Jewish community of Hebron. And we bring VIPs and we fed them beautifully and then toured and brought them VIPs to hear from, including Knesset member Itamar Ben-Gvir came and spoke, and chiefs, the brigadier general of the region came and spoke, et cetera, et cetera. So lots of logistics, but it's a very special thing. And for us in Hebron, where one of our big fights is to normalize Hebron, make it less scary, make it accessible, and therefore make it more ours in the eyes of Jewish people, people outside the land of Israel, and our own government, it's a big deal to succeed in making Chai Sara smooth and beautiful.
You mentioned Ben-Gvir. We'll come back to that in a moment. We're not going to let that pass. But you said normalize. That's your mission. That's your mandate. Normalize Hebron. And I think it's important for people to realize that you're normal. And what I mean by that is people try to picture these settlers from Israel, right? They're like, they're violent, they're cavemen, they're barbaric, they're archaic. Settlers are fundamental, they're extremists. They're painted in a certain light until you meet them. You know, my brother and his family live in Alon Shvut in Gush Etzion. He's a settler. He's a rabbi and a doctor, and my brother is the gentlest, sweetest person that ever walked the face of the earth. He's the farthest thing from the image. And you went to high school with me. We went to Frisch. You're a couple years younger than I am. You came back and you went to YU. You were a lawyer, Cordoza, correct? You graduated law school. You're a lawyer. And right before this episode, you were doing yoga. So when we talk about, you know, the settler, you're not a fanatic. You're not somebody who's an extremist. You're not some gum-touting violent. So talk to us about how did a kid who came from Frisch, Paramus, New Jersey, Frisch Cougar, how did you go from YU Cordoza and now be a spokesperson of this hotly contested city in the world stage called Hebron? How do you find yourself? Did you picture, is this what you thought you'd be doing when you were in high school and I was chasing you to get into davening? When you were in YU, when you were getting your law degree and whatever you thought you would do with your law degree, Did you picture that one day you'd be on all the major news stations? You'd have an op-ed printed in the New York Times, which drew a lot of controversy around it. Did you ever think that you'd be that spokesperson for Chevron and to a degree also for Israel?
Yeah. Did you apply for the job? Was there an opening international spokesman, or you just stepped in and you said, I'm doing
it? I had been, my predecessor was David Wilder, who had done a great job as a spokesman of Chevron for many years. And when he stepped down, I basically was like, David, you know, I heard you're stepping down. I want the job. And he recommended me. I had been in Jewish media for years beforehand. I was the manager of the Arutz Sheva English language radio station. Rabbi Ephraim, you talked a lot about like that I'm normal, that we're normal. The truth is that we're very passionate. We're not fanatical, but you know, and we accept others, and there's a love for other people, and there's no hate, and there's no like inner like violence. Quite the opposite. But we are quite passionate, and I think that the two of you are quite passionate. That's why you're doing the show. That's why you have such a successful synagogue that everybody, you know, talks about. That's why people are moving down towards you. I mean, people feel passion and they're drawn to it. I was a passionate young man. When my parents left Israel when I was 8 years old, I promised myself and said to my upstairs neighbors that I would be back for the army. And after my time at Frisch, I wanted to go back to serve in the army. I just knew inside my heart that if I didn't serve in the army, that would be something that would bother me. It's just a calling. I have to mention also my parents are Russian Jews who were also refuseniks in Russia. And there's like a tradition to be, you know, strong Jews. You know, my grandfather, you know, fought the Nazis and fought off the, you know, in the great siege of Leningrad. And so there's a tradition of being strong, and I didn't want to miss the opportunity to be a soldier in the Army of Israel, which is the first opportunity that we've had to do such a thing in 2,000 years.
When you did it, wasn't popular, right? Nobody.
It wasn't popular at all. It wasn't like today.
It's a big in thing.
Oh my gosh!
Halavai would be bigger, but today it's not usual. When you did it, nobody else did it.
You're absolutely right. When I was a lone soldier, that term meant that you were alone. It didn't mean that there was a whole organization embracing you, or you know, and that you know, you didn't have cell phones. You really were kind of alone, and you were an odd bird, and not everybody understood your challenges, just to get laundry done and stuff like that. But I just knew that I wanted to come back to the army, and do it, and it was, you know, it's something that later on also you did. I did reserve duty for many years, and something that I loved and felt great privilege to do it. When I came back to YU, to Yeshiva University. I really enjoyed Yeshiva University, and I love New York City. There, I said it. You know, I love New York City, and I love living in New York City. But I was kind of surprised that Jews were so – they didn't have that yearning to connect with Eretz Yisrael. So I started an Aliyah organization called Kuma, which meant the rise, and I just wanted to promote the consciousness of, like, we can go live in our homeland, not – disliking America. It doesn't come from this place of like, ew, you know, gosh, meus. No, it comes actually from like, the world is good. Hashem made a beautiful world, including the great New York City. And now let's go to our homeland and build it up. And we started that at the end of college, and it went into law school. And when I went to law school, I actually did go to law school with a consciousness that I wanted to learn American law, to go back to my home country, Israel, and to effectuate change, positive change with that kind of thinking. By the way, Ben Gurion, Herzl, and Jabotinsky all had law degrees from Vienna, from Turkey, whatever, from the different various places, and brought that way of thinking into creating a state. I wanted to do that. And Hashem has given me the opportunity, you know, in the way the person wants to walk the heavens take you. And Hashem has given me the opportunity to do just that, which is to help build Israel, to help create a bridge between the diaspora and Israel, to help hold hands across the Atlantic, to help consciousness of the centrality of our great mission of building the Jewish state, building Yerushalayim, is in our time. And what can I tell you? I the feelings that I'm telling you right now, I get a zing feeling every single day. Today I was at the Knesset. Today I was at the Knesset, you know, all afternoon, and I was just like, I can't believe I'm here. Hashem, just give me a chance to do something good to move this dream forward. So you get to live that every single day, and even with the challenges and all that stuff. And You know, I think that's what it means, the techlekeinu b'toratecha. Like, give us a chance to just be part of your dream and your and the stuff that you want to do in this world.
Your energy is absolutely infectious. So I want to ask you a question about Aliyah in a moment. But you mentioned Ben-Gvir before, and I believe you were even part of his campaign. Ben-Gvir is an enormously polarizing person, as you know, I don't have to tell you, in Israel, maybe even more so outside of Israel.
Yeah, in Israel, he's not so polarizing. In Israel, he's actually, you know, pretty much understood. It's well known that judges in the Supreme Court like him, Itamar Ben-Gvir. It's known that he's actually attractive in Israel, not so polarizing.
So in America,
but
though,
outside,
so you have this prominent a leader of the Reform movement, who there was a headline just the other day that I won't say his name, but one of the leaders of the Reform movement likened Ben-Gvir to a Ku Klux Klan leader. And he said Ben-Gvir's career derives from hate, ignites violence, warns his appointment to senior cabinet post could cause a rift with the U.S. And I'm reading directly from the headline. I know, on the other hand, Rabbi Dr. Danny Gordas, who, you know, we're fond of, wrote an article basically saying Israel had open, free, fair elections that are uncontested. Nobody challenges. This is the will of democracy and its people. And just like America elected first, first Trump, many people were deeply disappointed. Then Biden, many people were deeply disappointed. And who knows who's next and who will be deeply disappointed in. But free and open and clear elections, and kind of American Jews should not be telling Israelis who express their democratic right to vote and voted someone who might be misunderstood or is exaggerated. So tell the audience, I'm not weighing in here. I know there are people with very strong feelings that Ben-Gvir has certain heroes or has said certain statements or has advocated certain policies which are very difficult for people to accept or understand. He seems to have become a little bit more moderate, maybe in the election or since, in order to achieve some greater goals. And on the other hand, I have family in Israel who may have voted for him and said he's grossly misunderstood. They distort and manipulate, you know, who he is and what he stands for. And that's really unhealthy also. So give us maybe weigh in on both things. Number one, help those who don't know understand a side of Ben-Gvir that they don't. And I'm not bringing you on to kasher Ben-Gvir. That's not the purpose of that question, but help us understand. And number two, the bigger, broader question, do American Jews and do American Jewish leaders have a right to weigh in and to even sort of put an ultimatum about duly elected Israeli officials? If you're going to give them certain appointments, you're going to risk alienating us.
So with your permission, I'll answer the second question first, and then we'll go into who Ben-Gvir is. I think the diaspora certainly has a right to their opinion. That's obvious. But at the same time, it should be taken with a grain of salt, and I think should be spoken with some humility. Here in Israel, we're putting our kids on the line. Our wives are driving on these roads. Our children are going on you know, trips with their schools. And we are tired of living in fear. We want security. This is the life that we're leading. And so many people in Israel live in fear. Women are reportedly afraid to walk in Be'er Sheva at night, in the mixed Arab cities like Be'er Sheva, Akko, Yafo, Ramle Lud. Here in Jerusalem, not so far away from where I am right now, next to the university, there's an Arab village called Isawiya. And young Jewish women are afraid to walk around the university at night by themselves because of attacks. We know that people that live around Gaza are afraid of shelling. Businesses in the south and in the north pay protection money, protection rackets. For myself, living in Judea and Samaria, if I'm driving and I see a nice green hill, I just want to walk on that hill. I just want to pull my car over and walk on that hill. I can't do that because, you know, I have to be armed and be aware of the fact that it's dangerous. You know, there's so many tales. Recently, Mahmoud Abbas, the head of the Palestinian Authority, boasted that he helped pay for 7,200 attacks against Jews in the last year alone, and he helped fund that. We live in an atmosphere where there's a lot of hate and a lot of bullying around us. And the people of Israel that elected Ben-Gvir were like, can you please help us with security? Please help us with security. That's the majority of the issues that he's talked about. And that's what he keeps. I was today in one of the meetings, and he keeps saying, give us the internal security portfolio. Give us the Negev and Galil portfolio. We want to normalize life there. We want to bring it back from a place of fear. So with regards to the diaspora, a little bit of humility. You're not living in our shoes. I know that people in diaspora sometimes, especially in the more liberal circles, think that Israel projects its modus onto them, and they feel uncomfortable that Israel's more aggressive or whatever it is. Look, we live two different style lives. The style of the Jew in the diaspora is to speak truth to power. It's like, you know, a Jew in the foreign court, they call it in biblical literature, like Yosef in the court of Pharaoh. It's like it's a different way to subside and exist. Israel, we are the sovereigns. We have issues that we have to deal with. So it demands a different way of behaving. Not everything that we do has to broadcast onto you. And not everything that you feel about how Israel looks to you is something you should say in public. You don't like it. Okay, you don't like it. But we're living this life here. And just with a little bit of humility, if things would be said like, well, we understand Israel's right to choose, but it may make us uncomfortable. Maybe we have to learn more. Maybe we'll meet with Itamar. But instead, throwing out these terms like Ku Klux Klan, it's such an absurdity. Like the whole thing about Itamar Ben-Gvir is to you know, bring more security to Israel. That's the majority. Yes, there's been other statements and we can discuss this, but the majority thrust of what Itamar says is, let's give soldiers right to push back. Let's make stronger laws against terrorism, et cetera, et cetera. Now,
is that the part that you think got him so many votes? It was the security component of what he stands for that is what turned a lot of Israelis around about him.
No doubt about that. He by the way, is a very interesting character. He is a religious Zionist, but he comes from a secular home. He is what we call in Israel, Amami. He's like Sephardic, kind of like... Amami means, you know, of the people. It means the kind of people that work in the shuk or the taxi driver, the falafel guy. It means like from the nation. And he's got a way of being very clever and smart, a brilliant with media, but still being very much a man of the people. And in many ways, it's not his charisma that got all his votes. It's the fact that he said something that everybody else knows, which is we live in fear and we're tired of it. We're tired of living in fear. And so, and that's why people voted. I've heard many police officers.
Sorry to interrupt you, Isha, but how did the voter who voted for him, because they're tired of living in fear, how did they get past certain associations he has or glorifications he has or radical statements that he's made? You know, and again, I'm not, Behind the Bema is a very friendly and learning and warm and celebratory show. This is not a hard hitting type of show. That's not what we have Behind the Bema for. So I'm just trying to understand even myself is, can we say Palgin and Dibure? Do we separate out what people say or do? So, you know, the individual, I could vote for their security part of what they stand for. And the fact that maybe they've said some things or stand for some things that I disagree with or make me uncomfortable or even reject, that I'll ignore. How did people navigate that?
He went on TV, not TV. He was at a high school. Israeli high school, a secular Israeli high school. And they asked him all the hard questions. It's a wonderful 17-minute YouTube video, which has been seen lots and lots of times. And basically every question was asked, are you against the LGBT community? He says, no, I embrace them. I'm not here to be anti. It's not my cup of tea. I'm not going to be marching in the Gay Pride Parade. And I, you know, may think that it doesn't belong in certain places, but it's not my agenda to be anti and I embrace them. They said, you know, do you think that all the Arabs need to be kicked out? He says, no, I may have said things like that in the past, but today I understand that they're part of our society and even part of our nation. But of course, I'm anti-jihad, not anti-Arab. I'm anti-people who want to hurt soldiers, want to destroy our country, not anti-Arabs per se. He once pulled off, when he was a younger man, he pulled off the insignia of the Cadillac off of Rabin's car. And he said, you know, we could get to the prime minister as well. And then the part of the video that they cut out is when they asked him as a young man, what would you do if you met the prime minister? He says, I would yell at him. But they cut that part out. And the other part has become famous. And he said, I regret those. I regret those things. I apologize for that. You know, that's not the way to have discourse. They asked him about having a picture of Baruch Goldstein, who was a great doctor in Hebron, but also a man who perpetrated a massacre against Arabs in Hebron. And basically snapped when he was told that there was going to be a massive attack against Jews on that Purim. But he instead, you know, did this act, which we condemn without equivocation. But he said that he has apologized for having his picture up, that he was also his friend, and that he added up as a picture because he was also a great doctor that saved Arabs and Jews. But he apologized for that, and he's taken it down. People have noticed his moderation, and his moderation is something I'm very proud of, not only for the purposes of moderation, but also for the purpose of getting real legislation done. He is a pragmatic person who is also a very skilled advocate in Supreme Court in Israel. He's one of Israel's great lawyers. He's known as a civil rights lawyer and a great litigator. And so from that place, from the place of he was once convicted for putting up a racist sticker. That's it. The rest of the accusations were dropped. He said from there he's become a great lawyer, a great advocate, and now a great politician who's moderated his stances and views and wants to get real policy done to get us back on track. I must say to everybody here, Israeli Arab cities are full of guns. They tell us this. The mixed Arab cities and mixed Jewish Arab cities were incredibly violent. 10 synagogues were burnt in the conflict last May. We have untold amount of missiles in Gaza and in South Lebanon from Hezbollah and Hamas respectively. And we need to deal with these things. So here comes a guy who came from a more radical tradition and has moderated his views and is now saying, listen, let me take care of the arms against us, of the jihadist ideology against us. I'm not here against Arabs. And people accept that that's what we need right now. We need somebody that's going to have a more strong stance against that bullying, that jihadism, that criminality that Jews face. And by the way, he says this, and it's 100% true. The first victim of the jihad is the moderate Arab who is shut down, silenced, and even worse, if he says, hey, let's get along with Israel. So the phenomenon of Itamar Ben-Gvir is really the phenomenon of Israelis being tired of persecution and wanting to live Am Chofshi Be'Artzeinu under God.
And you'd say to Jewish leaders in America, get to know him, listen to him, maybe meet the new him, find common ground, maybe the things you could work on. And the things that you reject, feel free to reject. But the Israeli people have spoken, so sort of better to work with and better to understand. What would your message be to them?
Yeah, and what is this whole... I must say that the atmosphere of America, which is this divisive atmosphere, you're afraid of us in Israel broadcasting onto you. Like, calm the rhetoric down a little bit. Like, bat it down. Relax. Like, this is... Tom Friedman wrote an article saying, like, the Israel that you knew is gone. Actually, the Israel that you used to know is back, which is the tough Israel, which wants to push back on the bad guys. That's actually Israel's original kind of heritage. And American Jewish leaders, like, guys, like, why Israel's not going anywhere. You're not going anywhere. Let's calm the discourse. Let's have a relationship. Let's see where we can find common ground. You are our brothers and sisters. Let's not use this kind of terminology. Let's not use Ku Klux Klan. And somebody, Giora Island yesterday said something here from Israel, said that what happened in Hebron with some of the violence that Jews did against Arabs, these drunk Jews, he said this was like Kristallnacht. Everybody's got to calm down a little bit. Let's use language that's proper and constructive. And I think that I wonder what agenda it serves. When people use language like that, is it to popularize themselves, or are they really so used to this American divisive atmosphere, or do they want to get in the headlines? But it's not helping the common person understand Israel and understand Israel's needs. And my life for the last 25 years has been to bridge the gaps between Israel and the diaspora, to make sure that we're one people, and to get us together on the project of building the Jewish state wherever we are. I don't find this language helpful, and I hope that maybe if I continue helping the Ben-Gvir team, I'll try to manage a greater connectivity between those leaders and Itamar Ben-Gvir and people who think like him.
Rabbi Brody.
Wow, that's incredible. I'm just wondering, is he involved at all in your work with Hebron?
No, those are two separate things. Hebron is a city. Hebron is a tourist attraction, an educational platform. That's one thing. But he does live in Hebron. And so the way I got close to him is that a lot of people that know me and whatever I do in Hebron, recommended to him. I actually came to him and I said to him, listen, I think you're going to need my help for this campaign. And he's like, you're a great guy. I heard a lot of good things about you, but I don't need an English language you know, I don't need any help in that department. And then like a week later, Senator Menendez of New Jersey, you know, came out with this radical statement saying, you know, that if Itamar Ben-Gvir gets into Congress, it gets into Knesset or it becomes a minister, that will hurt the U.S.-Israel relations. I mean, it was such an absurd statement. And he called me, Itamar called me and said, you know, get to work. And we helped. Yeah. And these are absurd statements that would not be accepted within any other democracy. Nobody would. What kind of colonial, impulse is that to tell a people, you know, what their government should be, a democratically elected ally? It's just absurd. And Itamar Ben-Gvir made that point with a great press release. And Netanyahu himself said, hey, you know, Menendez and co, calm down. This is our country, and we're not a banana republic, and we're not going to be, you know, talked to in that way. And this comes from love. And, you know, we have a right to elect our leadership. And I think Senator Ted Cruz has done a great job also making that point heard and others.
And it should be said, Bob Menendez generally is a dear friend of Israel who's done great things, which is
absolutely
why it made headlines, because it was so unusual for him, because he is really a staunch friend, and we're so grateful. Particularly, we need bipartisan support. So, Yishai, I want to move over to something else.
I just want to say that the Ben-Gvir press release said that.
Right.
It thanked Senator Menendez for all of his good work towards Israel. It did not attack him. It just said, you know, let's respect each other's rights and please get to know me before you make statements like this.
Absolutely. You wrote an article I loved. You wrote a great article. And because it said something that I believe deeply, only you have infinitely more credibility to say it than I do. And it was after our fellow Floridian Ben Shapiro spent Sukkot in Israel and did a major event with Jordan Peterson and was asked at that sold out event about why he doesn't make Aliyah. And you wrote an article afterwards talking about Aliyah being non-binary, that maybe a younger version of you felt, hey, Jews, either you're with us, you make Aliyah, or if you didn't make Aliyah, you're not with us. And the reason it resonated deeply for me, and people who know I feel passionately about this, is the following reason. I have two siblings. They both live in Israel. My parents are in Israel right now. They spend half the year in Israel. And I desperately want to be in Israel. I would be in Israel. I believe we belong in Israel. And here in our shul, we don't talk about if, but when we will live in Israel. We celebrate those who've moved to Israel. We bring in and we host people like this conversation we're having right now. We're not shy. But I find that many people who've made Aliyah have a phenomenon that, you know, I like to call their Aliyah snobs. And what it means to be an Aliyah snob is somebody who maybe spent a good part of their life, certainly their youth, maybe even their adulthood. And from the day they moved to Israel, they no longer understand how anyone could live outside of Israel. And rather than positively appeal to and collaborate and invite, they actually alienate. So I, in my social media presence, will often speak about Israel or advocate for Israel. And there's a whole, I am ready for it. I already get ready for it. It's a cadre of people who will post publicly or write me privately, if you really cared about Israel, you'd make Aliyah. You know, or why are you doing a night for Israel that is 1,000 Jews and non-Jews? And we hosted last year. We're very proud of it. If you really cared about Israel, you'd make Aliyah. Or something happens. Or if there's a question or a conversation about anti-Semitism, they'll write, well, if you're afraid, really, you know, you kind of, they don't say this, but almost, you almost deserve this because really you should just make Aliyah. I was in Israel recently. I had several family simchas and at both of them, frankly, in two different cities. I won't mention where. And I get ready for this already now. How many people will come over to me and say, Rabbi, if you just go back and get up on the bima and say you're making Aliyah, the whole shul will go with you. So really, you're like the problem. Ezra Nehemiah, you know, we start to go through Jewish history together. I'm the problem. And it's so unhelpful. And it so makes me think twice before posting something, advocating positive, speaking out, because I don't want to get that onslaught of the Aliyah snobs. And I loved your article because what you essentially say is Aliyah is not binary. You're not either there or here. Aliyah, Israel is a central mission of the Jewish people. Torah learning in Israel, the Jewish people in Israel. We have three pillars, Am Yisrael, Eretz Yisrael, Torah Yisrael. It's core to who we are, what we daven for. It's part of our life, wherever we are. The kibbutz galios is not only geographic. It means our attention and our efforts and our contributions from wherever we are. And I have this dream. We've talked about it. We worked on it recently. We didn't follow through on that project. If you're listening, stop getting in touch. We did not follow through on a particular project. But I have this dream that says, instead of Vacation Village and instead of Century Village, a seasonal community in America, why can't we, for those who say, I want to be in Israel, I belong in Israel, I need to be, I will be in Israel, I'm not yet ready to make Aliyah, but I can spend my summer, I can go for Chagim, not an apartment I use 7 days a year, and raise the cost of living for all the Israelis in that neighborhood who can't get an apartment, but create a space, create a sort of vacation village, create a bungalow colony, just like the phenomenon in America that people go for a season. Why can't we put together a group of people who say, I want to live there for a season. I can't live there all year yet. I want to live there for a season. So I love that article. And you basically, I guess I'll pose it to you this way. Did you accept Ben's answer? Right, Ben, a little bit caught off guard, which he isn't often, past guest of Behind the Bima and our neighbor. So Ben kind of looked a little bit and he said, look, I think my shlichus, my mission, I'm making a difference there. And many Israelis did not accept that, did not like that. One might have thought you'd be among them. Instead, here you write this article that says, essentially, you know, I sort of accept that. It's not binary. We need friends everywhere. Could you elaborate a little bit more on that?
I have to tell you that I'm very moved by your question. It's something that I feel very strongly about. And I wrote that article. It came out of me, a lot of experience. And I didn't know if people all understood it, what I was writing. And you really, you know, understood what I was saying. And I'm very gratified and touched by that. And it's I got a lot to say about that, but I'll tell you a little story is that I was once reading a book called Millionaire Mind. Somebody told me to read this book. And sometimes, you know, sometimes you read a non-Jewish book and it gives you like a ha'ara, like an understanding in the Jewish concept. And he says, if you want to be a millionaire and you're a kind of guy that walks past the millionaire's house and you kind of curse them or put an ayin hara on them and you're kind of jealous of them, if you don't know how to bless that other millionaire and just say, God bless you and may you continue to be successful, you'll never be a millionaire. And I was like, that is so true. That's what I want to be in this world, a person who draws positivity and light, blessings for people. I don't want to go to America and say, oh, you're building another shul here. What do you need it for? Come to Eretz Yisrael. I want to bless you. I want to come here and send you a blessing, send you a connectivity. I want to look at you. So I start my speeches a lot of times, end my speeches. I say to people, I want to bless your rabbi. I want to bless your mikvah. I want to bless your kosher food. I want to bless your school and bless the shul. And then I say, let's take a step towards connectivity to Eretz Yisrael. What's the step that you're going to take? What's the little step are you going to take? And one that I've recommended and has had the most impact, as I say to people, just buy wine and drink kosher wine from Eretz Yisrael Friday night. Friday night, make kiddush on wine from Eretz Yisrael and tell your kids and tell your neighbors, this is wine from the Holy Land. Not because I'm supporting the Holy Land. So Holy Land supporting me. It's going to go into my veins. And this is the water that Eliyahu drank. I'm going to drink it now. And here I am. And if you're I was just recently in Aventura, Florida. It's Sarah's tent. And you could buy, I don't know what they have in Boca, but certainly in Sarah's tent, you could get wines from like every part of Eretz Yisrael. In short, we've got to build bridges, not cut bridges down. We need to support people. And I know so many people who are lawyers who come for the summer. And these men work at night while their wives and kids, you know, grow up in Eretz Yisrael for the summer because the kids are up. I know lawyers in America, this is from Cardozo Law, who hire only Israelis, not only, but like a lot of Israeli lawyers so that they could give Israelis parnassah. We have so many things that we do, so many steps that we take. How many people in your community now also own an apartment in Israel? How many people in your community send their kids to the army or to Aliyah or to Yeshiva for a year or two, whatever it is? We are building bridges. And to come to people and to be snooty, which is a human instinct, you know, but it's not building bridges. It doesn't bring people any closer. It's just a mistake. And you pointed it out better than I could. It's just a mistake. It's not the way to do it. And people have their situations. They have their parnasa. They have their moms and dads. They have their kids in the school. They're afraid of this or that. There's a million reasons that their wife, he wants to go, but she doesn't want to go. She wants to go, he doesn't want to go. I mean, I see that all the time. So instead of telling people like, wow, you're up a creek because your wife doesn't want to go, I tell them, well, okay, so what step are you going to take? You know, what little thing? You know, are you going to come for the summer? Are you going to budget every year a trip to Eretz Israel? Send your kids to camp in Israel, one of those OU camps. You know, send your daughter to go to Bar Ilan. You know, if your son says, I want to go to the army, let him. And of course, I always tell people, buy an apartment. That's I don't even tell people to make Aliyah. I said, buy an apartment. It's good for your money. Maybe you'll tell me, maybe it changes your halachic status in terms of if you should keep one day or 2 days in Eretz Yisrael. Our job is to put people in the game, not out of the game. Our job is not to be snooty to our brothers and sisters, but to hold hands. Our job is to bless the communities around the world and give them a light of Israel. By the way, when people send money to support them, what is money? Money is your sweat, your effort. In Hebrew, another word for money is damim. It's your blood, and the blood has the neshama in it, the Torah tells us. So part of you is making aliyah. Your money is making aliyah to Eretz Yisrael. It's like it's your hard efforts is going to Eretz Yisrael. I respect that so much. And by the way, there's another group of people. There's the people who make aliyah, but fly. There's, you know, you go to Modin or what do you call it, Chashmonaim there. These are all guys and gals. Who ladies and men who like fly. I have my good friend Dr. Wiesen, who is a doctor in Florida, but he lives here in Efrat, and he flies to Florida, you know, once a month for a week to do emergency medicine. There's so many ways to live it, and the Kodesh Baruch Hu has given us a time of Ayinu Kichol Meim. He's opening it up. Why should we close it? Say no. You got to be just like this. This is the way to do it. Hashem has given you an opportunity. You know that there's 11. I counted 11 direct flights from the New York, New Jersey area to Israel every day. Every day, 11 flights. And from Florida, there's many flights, and I'm thankful to
daily.
Allow.
Daily is from American Airlines. They just announced it.
Right. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. And you have Elal. And that's not even the stopover flights. If you count right. that and forget about it, then there's tons of airlines.
Kibbutz Galios, yeah.
Kibbutz Galios, that's exactly it. Shivat Zion, we're building together. Now, what I do ask is, can we get around the idea that the mission of our time is to help build Eretz Israel? That the central big project of the Jewish people is the building of Yerushalayim and Eretz Yisrael. That's our central project, no matter where you are. Let's get around this idea that that's the project of our life, of our time, mm-hmm. of these generations. But you know what? Like BRS, for God's sakes, that's the shul that's like...
We're trying. And I'll just tell you, by the way, for all those listening, if I got up, Rabbi Brody, if I got up and started making Aliyah next week, who's in? How many people would come? Maybe you. Maybe.
First of all, I would be on that flight with you.
That's not why I'm not going, right. Because people wouldn't come. But it's a misnomer. Life's complicated. It's nuanced.
It is complicated.
People have all kinds
and you're on Shlichut. And you're on Shlichut. You're teaching Torah there. You're bringing generations up. And
I was just at
your light, that positivity and that connectivity, and it's so refreshing. We love it. Thank you.
Yeah.
It came from real life experience. It came from flying to America and realizing that I don't want to be that guy that doesn't spread the love and the light. I want to be the guy who brings a spark of Eretz Yisrael and, by the way, takes a spark back to Eretz Yisrael and brings the best of America back. Kitzer Maisa, let's not be snooty to one another. It doesn't bring anywhere. Let's love. Amen. Let's rahav to lecha kamocha. Let's hold each other's hands. Let's Amen. Strengthen the diaspora Jewish community. Let's get around the project of Israel. Let's take small steps that we can to love one another and to be on the same page.
Amen. Rabbi Brody, final word?
I love it. I'm just wondering, do you see a lot of the children of those living in America now making aliyah and bringing their parents? Do you see more and more of that happening?
I see all kinds of phenomena. I see all kinds. I see the army, yeshiva kids at Hakotel or at Leva Torah being like, I'm going to the army. And by the way, like there's a class of, let's say, 50 or 100. So 2, 3, 5 want to go to the army, but it's normative. I see American Jews sending their kids to Israel. That's become totally normative for the year and staying later. I see parents more supportive of kids saying, I want to stay in Israel.
Right.
I see that. I see more people buying apartments in places like Beit Shemesh. And my friends who sell apartments tell me that, you know, there's just a run on purchases. And when I go to Sarah's tent, I see a lot of Israel, you know, there, and sending its, you know, its blessings. Kids are, in short, that's why, back to the other question of Itamar Ben-Gvir, those reform rabbis that made those statements, they're not helpful to anybody. Why should we like promote this idea of distance? Let's promote the idea of closeness. Yeah, we're not the same. We have different ways that of governance and the different survival methods. But we should not fan the flames of distance, but rather, you know, seek to embrace. And there's all kinds of phenomenon. Another phenomenon, by the way, is the IAC, the Israelis living in America who have conglomerated together for a wonderful organization. Many of their, they have Israeli culture in their house. Many of their kids make Aliyah. Many of their kids go to the army. So amazing. In short, you know, and I guess maybe it's back to Hebron. You know, Hebron is from the word Chibur. And the main thing about Hebron is the mothers and fathers together. These are men and women who came together in love to build a family, to give birth to a nation. That's why I call it the tomb of the patriarchs and matriarchs. It's about, you know, coming together. That's what Am Yisrael is about. You know, and Yerushalayim is Ir Shechubra Leichdam. It's a city that joins us all together. You know, can American Jews, by the way, come more for Sukkot and for Pesach? Yes. You know, and for Shavuot, Regalim, great. Come for Regalim. You know, listen to the opportunity of our time. Buy that apartment. But looking down, I don't think that's the way to move forward.
Yishai, keep doing what you're doing. Let's leave it right there. What a perfect place. Thank you for all that you're doing. Thank you for your efforts. Thank you for your energy. Thank you for your soul and your spirit. Thank you for your friendship. Really, thank you for all that you're doing. It's been a fantastic, eye-opening conversation. And we wish you and the Holy Hebron community, and we wish all of our brothers and sisters in Israel and around the world only Chibur and Hebron, only that connection and that unity and that love. Thank you so much for going behind the bima with us.
And let me send you a blessing to this great show, to the great Kiddush Hashem that you're doing, your wonderful shul, your wonderful community that is a light. A lot of people I've heard a lot of people are touched by what you're doing and continue to have success. And Hashem should continue to keep us together and strong. Man.
All right, folks, I hope you enjoyed Behind the Bima, where I got to appear on this kind of renowned podcast and show. It was really an honor and a pleasure, and I thank them. And I want you to check out the Behind the Bima podcast and show. It's on YouTube, and it's all over the place, and it's strong in the Orthodox Jewish world. And if you want the perspective of the Orthodox Jewish world, and if you want to learn oodles of Torah, check out Rabbi Goldberg's regular Torah podcasts. He is just a master teacher and puts out tons and tons of awesome content. All right, folks, I want to thank again all the folks that make this show happen. Yocheved Seidman, Ben Bresky, Moshe Herman, Tabitha, and Lou, when we're live, for putting the show together, for getting it out to the world. Please rate it highly if you can in your podcast listenership places. If you could send it to friends and family, that would be great. If you want to support the show through buymeacoffee.com/Yishai. If you want to go to yishaifleisher.com, see the rest of my content, including videos, articles, and of course our projects here in Israel that you could support. That's all there. I want to thank all of our sponsors, which I already discussed in the previous half, but they make all the difference in the world for our show. And I want to thank God Almighty for the opportunity to speak it out, to talk about His vision, to talk about His great miracles, to be on His team at any level is the greatest honor and gift. And if you're listening to the show, you are on that team. Don't doubt it. You are in this generation and this time, and you are part of the story. If you listen to this part of the, if you're here at the end of the podcast, that means that you are a person of great concern about the time that we live in, and you want to be active, you want to be part of it, and I'm telling you that you are empowered to be part of God's great dream. All right, folks, more great stuff is on the way. Stay tuned, stay strong, stay connected. Lots of love from the Holy Land. I'm standing here in Hebron right now in the beautiful Tel Rumeda next to the tomb of Ruth and Yishai, and I'm sending you blessings from the Davidic kingdom to wherever you are in the world. Lots of love and shalom.